And this is KPCW. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Thursday morning, April 23rd. 30 degrees and snowing here in Old Town Park City. And 36 degrees in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for a look at your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Thursday, starting off with more winter-like conditions out there for you with those chilly temperatures. And yes, we've got scattered snow showers making their way through the area, especially for most of the Wasatch back right now. Now, the good news is this will last off and on through about lunchtime today with some light accumulations possible, especially as you get above about 7,000 feet where we could pick up a couple of inches of snow, just a dusting or so below that. Otherwise, temperatures for highs today in the mid-40s for us in Park City. We'll see those highs in the mid-50s in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into tonight, we'll start to dry things out. We'll keep it partly cloudy going into your Friday. Temperatures will be warming into the mid-50s in Park City. We'll see those highs back in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. So those snow showers will not stick around too long for whatever that may actually be able to accumulate. Now, as we go into your weekend forecast, we start off fairly calm with partly cloudy skies on your Saturday. We will introduce a chance of isolated showers and thunderstorms arriving Saturday afternoon, probably late into the afternoon and evening hours. And it's just a chance. We'll see those highs in the upper 50s before that in Park City on Saturday, with highs in the mid-60s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Sunday, we've got a stronger storm system coming our way, and this system will bring a little bit more moisture with it as well. So look for a good chance of rain, actually, as we go into your Sunday in the Heber Valley, with temperatures starting off in the mid-30s with highs in the low 50s on your Sunday. Meanwhile, Park City will see a cold rain event taking place there, maybe even a few snowflakes mixed in by the afternoon and evening hours, with temperatures only in the 40s for highs in the Park City area on your Sunday. As we make our way into Monday, any leftover moisture Sunday night into Monday will likely change over to another chance of snow showers. So look for some light accumulations possible. Temperatures dipping down to near the freezing mark. We'll see highs only in the 40s on your Monday in Park City, with highs in the 50s in the Heber Valley. Let's look at your latest forecast with the Wasatch back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. In just a minute, we'll be checking in with Summit County Council member Megan McKenna. Later on, Woodward Park City General Manager Gar Trainer in with a recap of this winter and what's coming up for this summer. And from the Village Bicycle Project, Executive Director Joshua Popple tells us more about the May 2nd bike collection event here in Park City. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include Bill Johnson, a geology professor at the University of Utah. He explains new research uncovering a hidden freshwater aquifer beneath the Great Salt Lake Playa and the contribution that it could make to healing the lake. Then author and technology executive Fred Vacala explains why AI-first organizations are already seeing dramatic productivity gains and why companies that fail to adapt may not survive the next decade. All of that coming up on Cool Science Radio, of course, heard every Thursday from 9 to 10. In the studio now with a recap from yesterday's Summit County Council meeting, I have council member for District 2, Megan McKenna. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with the legislative recap that you got. Summit County's lobbyists from Foxley and Pignatelli recapped the session. It's been more than a month since it ended, but they mentioned the bill that requires Summit County to pay Morgan County taxes on the portion of the 910 Cattle Ranch property that's in Morgan County. It sounds like there is wider opposition to that bill from other counties that could be affected. So what's the status of this? Is it going to get repealed, changed? What's going to happen?
Yes, you're referring to House Bill 445. This is one that we worked closely with. Representative Strong was the one who brought this bill forward. And you're right, I think the implications for other counties, I think many are just realizing, and so we'll likely see some attempts to change or amend it. But right now, the bill, it has passed. The governor signed it, so it is in law.
Yeah, what you heard from the lobbyists, that the impact isn't that big of a deal, but there are conversations between Morgan County and Summit County about an agreement. Can you share more about what that agreement looks like?
Yeah, and this is several of us testified, and we actually already had an interlocal agreement with Morgan County when this bill came out, and that's why we were a little bit surprised that it specifically targeted us here in Summit County. But it really, the bill didn't impact what we had already done. So by purchasing the 910, there is a portion that's in Morgan County, and we had been working with them on that agreement at the time, and so this really won't impact that. Our concern was really going forward and future land purchasing restraints that this bill would put on, and the impact on other counties. As was mentioned last night, Salt Lake County will be impacted by this bill.
So what's the proposal then to how to govern or to pay for the property in the 910 that is in Morgan County?
Well, we had already had an agreement that we would pay taxes on that. And so that's what this bill says, that you need permission, express permission from the county that where the land is, and that land would not be exempt. And so that was our concern. If what happens if you don't get permission from the other county? Does that, and this impacts all taxing entities, you know, so thinking about school districts and fire districts. Just maybe unintended consequences is really our concern moving forward. But like you said, this really doesn't impact what we've already done to this point.
Okay. The small lots and starter home bills, I think it was House Bill 184 that would facilitate development, failed. There were concerns about how affordable these starter homes would be, and not likely in Summit County, which has such a high median income. So apparently mayors from cities testified against it. Can you offer any more information about why the bill died?
Yeah, I think for the reasons you listed, I think affordability is a concern across the state. And so I think cities, the league came out strong against this, you know, limiting cities or counties' ability to address affordability in a meaningful way, where local government really understands the issues more than, you know, this idea that one size fits all across the state is challenging when we talk about affordability, and, you know, especially here in Summit County, where our AMI is so much greater than in other communities.
Yeah, I mean, this was, though, a big, a big deal for the governor and certainly some lawmakers. So should we expect it to come back in some kind of form? Or?
Yeah, I think we do expect this to come back. I think housing is definitely a priority at the state. And so this is something that we want to continue to work on with the governor's office and our legislators to find real solutions to affordable housing.
And that's what I'm wondering. I mean, is Summit County part of this conversation to say, hey, look, we don't disagree with the premise for it, but that's not going to work here, and there's a need to be not so, you know, not such a broad-based bill, but something else that would be tailored for specific communities.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think Summit County is alone in that. I think counties across the state and cities and towns feel the same. And so we all work, you know, with our associations, whether it's the League or with UAC, and with our lobby teams, with our economic development and housing teams. We certainly work with our legislators. And that's why, you know, as Jana mentioned in the beginning, you know, one of our priorities in this session is always to build relationships and to continue to work with our lawmakers and the governor's office.
All right, Senator Ron Winterton, who represents a portion of Summit County, also ran a bill that would make the county council the executive branch of a county that has a council manager form of government. It did fail. So do you know why this was, you know, filed? I mean, did it have to do with Summit County or...
No, this one actually, it didn't have to do with Summit County. Jana mentioned this too last night, that Senator Winterton is often looked at as the senator for local government. You know, he comes from county, and so when these bills come up, they often go to him. He's kind of the one that works on a lot of these, and he mentioned actually this one I think came out of Tooele from some concerns they have with their form of government. And we were able to work with him on this. Senator Winterton was really great in expressing interest in the interim and working with us to find some solutions.
Okay. You mentioned that you're interested in the artificial intelligence bills cropping up in the legislature. What would you like to see, some state-level regulation, or do we see it like Heber City's just done, you know, implement its own AI policy?
Yeah, both. I think this is a really important issue that we're all faced with at the moment. I would love to see some state policy addressing AI concerns. Representative Fifia, I think is how you say his name. He was certainly in the news trying to push some state policy, and I think local government is also looking to get local policy, as Heber has done. Summit County is working on their own AI policy at the moment, so we'll have something coming forward soon.
Okay, let's see. Jeff Jones, Economic Development Director, introduced one of his statistical tools. Is it Placer AI?
Placer AI, yes.
Yeah, and it tracks cell phone data and apparently can show Summit County where people go and when they go. And I think it's been used a way to track tourists. Is this a better version of the visitation data that the Park City Chamber uses?
I don't think it's better. I think it's another tool. And really, with all of this data, I think, you know, using it to compare, and when you see trends, you know, across the sources, it just gives you a little bit more confidence. But yeah, the Placer AI, it's anonymized, it's aggregated. So what they do is they take all of this information from our smartphone apps. There's no personal data shared. It really is just showing movement across the county. And so I think this will be a really valuable tool. There's a lot of implications that we can use this. And so Jeff presented some examples and was looking for some feedback on how we'd like to use it in the county.
Yeah, he threw a lot of numbers at council and wanted to know how council wants staff to use this. So what did the council say? What is the best use for this?
Yeah, I think we are all interested in seeing more. I think it's going to be really valuable with transportation and mobility planning, with workforce development, with land use, urban planning, and also, as you mentioned, with restaurants, hospitality, retail, shopping. I think all of those will be really valuable data points.
Okay, so if you turn your cell phone off, it doesn't count, right? I mean, is there any way to track it?
No. No, this is just from phones that are on.
Okay. Let's see. County behavioral staff presented the results of a survey regarding mental health and behavioral health. Overall, so-called stigma seems to be declining. Availability of services going up, so that all seems good. What's that attributed to?
Well, I think it shows the work that is being done in our community. Erin Newman, our behavioral health director, and Anna Fraschow, from our Mental Wellness Alliance director, presented the behavioral health survey data. And the last time we did this was in 2021. So showing, you know, 6 years of some of them, you know, were slight increases. But as you mentioned, trends going in the right way. I think awareness of resources has gone up. The responses unable to get services, that has gone down. The need for services has gone down. People being able to identify others needing help, that has gone up. The ability to talk about mental health, that saw a pretty good increase. And so I think those show the trend that we would like to see. And I think that's attributed to the work that is being done in our community. But clearly there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. The presenter said that more and more locals are saying they identify as a Summit County or Park City resident, or that those places are part of their identity. And of course, we've got lots of transplants here. I guess so. How does identifying with the place that you live contribute to mental or behavioral health?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it really shows high engagement, which I think is a positive thing. I think when people identify with their community, they feel part of it and want to engage and improve it. And so I think that's a positive thing.
All right, let's see. After Kimball Junction's McDonald's asked for a special exception to renovate its drive-through signs recently, the county council asked staff to revise the drive-through sign regulations. Del Taco watching that decision with interest. Can you summarize the changes that were approved?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, this came from a special exception that was granted, and it seemed at the time when it was presented to us that it was necessary to update the code with just how technology has changed. The applicant let us know last time that the technology from the old signs isn't even available. And so some of the changes, and this was really great to see the county, our planning team working with Scenic Utah, which advocates for dark skies and dark sky ordinances and policy. And so they worked with them to try to figure out, you know, how can we update our codes, but also comply with our dark sky ordinance. And so what was established is these digital menu signs in addition to gas station signs. They can use digital signs, but they'll be limited to, it's called NITS. That's the unit of measurement for digital illumination. So similar to lumens, but for digital screens. And so that was limited to 200. And I think that was the main part.
Okay. All right. Anything else from last night's meeting?
Well, you know, it was a great meeting. I think we learned a lot. You know, you mentioned the Placer AI. I think some of the information that came out that really stood out to me is our out-of-market visitors has gone down over the last 5 years, and our employees has gone up significantly. So visitation down 5% based on this data, and employees up 46%. And so just thinking about some of the issues, you know, that we're faced with as we look at our land use and upcoming development, just thinking how this can help inform decisions. And also, I'd like to mention, if I have a moment, that the Upwards, our facilitator for our child care scholarship program, just released their 2-year impact report. And so this was really exciting as well. And I think this data will help us in Park City, who have invested, you know, $1.6 million the last 2 years in this program, kind of next steps in where we want to go forward. And the really exciting return on investment in this program, 325%. So it's an estimated $5 million return on investment on that $1.6 million. And so this is really exciting, seeing the impact of what we've been able to do here in Park City and in Summit County. And hopefully other communities are able to replicate this program.
Now, how do you figure a return on investment on giving people money for childcare? I don't follow.
Yeah, I think it's based on, I mean, you can look at the report to see exactly, you know, how they came up with these numbers, but it's based on sustained family earnings, avoiding turnover, increased productivity, reduced work absences, and just economic relief to the families.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you, Leslie.
Well, the Snyderville Basin's Water Reclamation District regularly tests the area's wastewater to know what viruses are spreading locally. KPCW's Sydney Weaver reports Summit County Health and the district are now going deeper with the first study of its kind in the state.
The Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District calculates a monthly flush index that can help identify visitor numbers and what infectious diseases like COVID-19 and measles may be in the county. But now the district, the Summit County Health Department, and the Public Health Laboratory in Salt Lake City have partnered to expand its testing for the state's first wastewater metagenomic study. District Director Mike Lors says it will help examine the health of the community.
In a nutshell, what that is this is where the wastewater samples are sent to the laboratory, and all of the genetic material, the bits and pieces of the RNA and DNA, are sequenced And the goal is to look for pathogens, antimicrobial resistant bacteria, and other potentially harmful microbes.
He says so far, the county is looking good. Metagenomics is the study of genetic materials in specific samples. Lors says it's like putting together a complicated puzzle.
Think of a very large box, say the size of your house, filled with jigsaw puzzle pieces. However, each piece in the box is from a different puzzle. Now, the task is to assign each piece of the puzzle to a specific puzzle. So you go to a repository and you compare each piece to a repository that has millions and millions and millions of pieces, and you come up with a unique sequence so you can make a match.
The six-month study will collect information about what diseases are in the area, not just specific illnesses the district has tested for in the past. Summit County Health Department epidemiologist Nancy Porter says the study will be especially helpful to identify illnesses popping up earlier or staying longer.
We've seen a slower rollout for RSV, too. And so that's something that normally is in the winter, but we've been seeing an extended season. It kind of shifted a little bit.
She says wastewater studies help officials warn residents about what's going on around town and how to best protect themselves. They also allow the health department to notify hospitals about the diseases to watch for in patients. Lors says the recent improvements in technology and genetic material sampling have made examining large samples of data possible and more affordable.
The genome of most pathogens have now been sequenced, and collectively all of those genomes have been placed in a worldwide genome repository, so that if you run a sample and you want to know genetically, is this associated with, say, polio? You can go to that repository and it matches.
Lors says each monthly test is about $250 to look at hundreds of pathogens. The departments will split the cost and determine how to proceed after the six-month trial. Sydney Weaver, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from Woodward Park City, it's General Manager Gar Trainer. Good morning, Gar.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. So this winter brought unusually low snowfall and warmer temperatures. How did those conditions impact operations at Woodward?
Yeah, it's a great question, Leslie. Just to put some context into that, you know, if you look at the snowfall that we got, we recorded 60 inches of natural snow this winter. And we can compare that to the winter of 22-23, when I think we measured, you know, 260-something then. So significantly different. Yeah, there was a lot of challenges presented. Warm temperatures, on average, our high temperature waymarker sat at 48 degrees compared to the previous year, which was 40, so an 8-degree swing there. So it was a little bit of a battle for our operational teams. We had to make snow in far smaller windows and chunks than we've ever had to do before. It was a challenge, but, you know, our team stepped up to the plate and certainly didn't leave the bat on the shoulder. They swung hard, and ultimately we provided a really, really excellent product for our guests.
So I guess they were on call 24/7 because some of the temperatures didn't come until, you know, three in the morning.
There was some nights where we thought we were going to get temperatures and you've got full staff on ready to make snow, and then it didn't come. And then other nights when it would just appear out of nothing. You know, we benefit in our location from a bit of an inversion. The inversion is really difficult to track and understand when it's going to hit to be able to make snow in, because it's very dependent on air pressure. Our teams did great. We consolidated our footprint a little bit because we could, and we really focused on a sort of marginalized footprint and focused on keeping that as good and high quality as possible, and as many refreshes throughout the season as we could in terms of the terrain park and the setup.
Yeah, so how much do you rely on snow making?
I mean, Leslie, this year, you know, with 60 inches of natural snow and those warmer temps, it's very reliant on snowmaking, yeah.
Yeah, on a regular year, though?
On a regular year, slightly less so, but, you know, it is a variable that we can control more so in terms of hitting opening dates being able to kind of stay ahead of having a terrain park and learning areas that are, like, sharp on a daily basis.
Yeah. Now, did you see changes in visitor numbers compared to a typical winter?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were for sure a little bit down. We saw that across town, tracking down with destination guests. I saw change in the consumer behavior. In my analysis, we're seeing that skiers and riders were skiing in more consolidated windows, 2 and 3 hour sessions. versus day-long commitments. That was the biggest thing that we saw. So we saw a lot of turnover in our parking lot of people coming and going throughout the day, a lot of people riding after work and not taking those days off work that they would normally do. But on the whole, visitation, yes, it was slightly down, but you know, the locals really stepped up. I think the convenience for us, for both the Park City community and the Salt Lake community and the broader community, is the convenience is always on. You know, it's so easy to get there directly off 80, easy parking, straight to the lift. You know, so it's not the commitment that you have to make in many other destinations.
Yeah. Woodward, of course, known for its progression in sport. So I guess, how did your team have to innovate to kind of keep the guests engaged, you know, despite the limited staff?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to staff. It comes down to people and creating incredible experiences for guests. Our lesson and programming numbers were up this year, and engagement was really, really high. So that was a great thing to see. And that's both both for locals and for destinations. So you're creating these incredible experiences for destination guests as well as our local community.
Yeah. Now, did you see our offer more indoor offerings then as a result?
I mean, we continually evolve our sort of programming and offerings and really try and cater for many. You know, we're lowering the barrier of entry as much as we possibly can at any given time and meeting the consumer where they are to understand what do they want to learn? How do they want to be better? You know, and that's ages and stages, all different ages. Adult night on Tuesday nights was really well attended. People getting right into that, you know, all the way till 9 o'clock at night, indoors, hitting trampolines, hitting mega ramps, skate parks, you know, just having an absolute blast.
Okay, so this is an adults only, huh?
Yes.
18 and over, or is that?
18 and over from 7 till 9 on Tuesday nights.
Oh, okay. All right. So any improvements or changes that you're planning for next winter, kind of based on this year's experience?
I mean, we'll do a little bit of work on our snowmaking infrastructure. You know, winters like this past year, to your point earlier, where we see the need. So that's just a constant sort of maintenance project. And then, you know, again, the business is 7 years old, so we're still like tweaking and sort of tidying things up, really, from evolution over the years. And then, you know, we'll reset and look for an incredible summer this year and moving on into next winter.
Okay. And then in terms of any new features or something, are you pretty much built out and you've got what you got?
For now, yeah. There might be some fun things coming in the future that we're discussing, but nothing that we're ready to disclose yet, but we'll let you know first, Leslie.
Okay. So, of course, you've got a reputation as a year-round destination. What's on tap for this summer?
Lots. We have summer camp. Starts second week in June, right when the kids get out of school. 10 weeks of summer camp. 5 different offerings. So we have multi-sport, mountain biking, scooter, BMX, and skateboarding. So that's our big sort of summer lift, and then multiple events and activations sort of sprinkled into that, as well as our weekly programming inside in the hub and outdoors, all the way from micros, so 3 through 17 years old. There's programming at all times that we have on offer to engage with the youth and really promote that progression.
All right, so you have some kind of calendar online at this point?
Yeah, if you go on our website, you can see all of the calendar of our programming. We have weekly and seasonal programming, and then, of course, summer camp coming up real quick. But the shoulder season programs are getting really good engagement, and the kids are absolutely loving it.
Yeah, and how does that work? I mean, do you continue to do the season passes or the membership where people can kind of come and go as they want? Or?
Yeah, so this past year, we kind of switched our model. So we always have our all-access membership, which is our sort of premier product for the consumer that is just always on. And then we have our mountain park winter season pass, and then our mountain park summer season pass, mm-hmm. which is on sale now. So that offers you all of our mountain biking trails. We have 6 trails, 5 miles of trail, along with our start park and our learning zones as well.
And does that get you access to the inside as well?
No, that's just an outdoor product. And then the indoor product is mostly provided through daily access or through our all-access membership.
Got it. Okay, let's see. How important is the summer season to your overall business model?
Yeah, it's really important. The most important thing in my mind about the summer season, similar to other resorts that put summer operations in, is really so that you can maintain a strong staffing year round. You know, it's a really important part to our model that builds to the consistency of the product that we can deliver and the engagement and satisfaction of our staff as well.
Right. You want to keep those coaches engaged, right?
Yeah.
So that they, right.
Yeah, we want to keep them with a Woodward shirt on for as long as we possibly can, and grow those coaches, grow the operators, so that they really understand both our business model, but also our community and our culture and our guests.
Yeah. How would you guesstimate the breakdown between local and destination visitor? Is it the majority locals?
Yeah, I would say if you look at the annual calendar, it's probably about 75% is local.
Okay. Let's see. And I guess with climate variability becoming more common, I mean, how do you kind of see the future of winter action sport evolving?
I think it's a difficult one. I think we can look at a winter like this and almost knee-jerk. But I think when we look at our rolling averages, I think we're okay for now. I think do we need to be very, very mindful of all of the things that we know that are factually true that are happening, of warming and more challenging winters? Yes. I think seasonality might change a little bit, might consolidate a little bit. I think the guarantee of skiing on Thanksgiving is a challenge. I think the guarantee of incredible skiing at Christmas is a challenge, but I think like all the resorts around here, is if we just keep doing our best to provide the best possible experience and add auxiliary experiences around the core outdoor activities of skiing and snowboarding, then certainly in the short term we can continue to be a leader in tourism as a destination guest and continue to provide an incredible product and an opportunity for locals as well.
Okay. Well, I know you do partnerships with YSA to get kind of kids out to play, both summer and winter?
Yeah, both summer and winter for ski, snowboard, and mountain biking. Also, we do indoor classes with YSA as well.
Yeah, and any other partnerships that you have?
Yeah, we work with around 10 local community partners. So Wasatch Adaptive is one of them. We do programming with Salt Lake School District. Yeah, Live Like Sam. We have an event with Live Like Sam, Leading with Kindness, next month, which we did it for the first time last year, and it was a great turnout. And it really has this arts and crafts and community engagement to it, which is just a really fun sort of opportunity for the kids to express themselves.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No. Thank you for having me, Leslie.
Okay. Glad to have you. Gar Trainer is the general manager of Woodward Park City. Thanks for your time. Well, Village Bicycle Projects is having its annual spring Park City Bike Drive May 2nd. On the phone with details, I have the project's executive director, Joshua Popple. Good morning, Joshua. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, so start by telling us, what is the Village Bicycle Project?
Village Bicycle Project is a nonprofit that's been operating for 26 years now. Our mission is to send bikes to low-income populations in West Africa, primarily school children, to give them better access to education and affordable transportation.
Now, why Africa?
Well, the organization was started by a former Peace Corps volunteer, and he recognized the need for cheap and affordable transportation in a lot of these rural areas, and so that's where we started working. We initially began our operations in Ghana in 1999 and then expanded to Sierra Leone about 10 years later.
Talk a little bit about how a bicycle changes the daily life for people in places like this.
Yeah, it really has an amazing impact. Most of the areas that we work, the road infrastructure is minimal. It's a lot of like dirt roads, rutted roads that get washed out in the rainy season. Particularly with the school children that we work with, they can be walking as much as 5-6 miles each way to school, which is about a 2-hour one-way journey. And the ability to get a bike into the hands of some of these kids, it reduces their travel time significantly. They can usually cover that distance in about a third to the fourth of the time, which means that they have more time to focus on their studies, their homework, and also help out with other family chores and responsibilities.
All right. I guess beyond transportation, any other impacts that you've seen from the program? And it sounds like, yeah, that the kids are, again, able to study more, help out. Anything else?
We work with healthcare workers as well, which also allows them to greatly expand the reach of the number of people that they're able to access every day. And then the other population that we work with is rural farmers. And we find that having a bicycle enables them to get to their fields a lot quicker and also get their products to market and carry a greater load to those markets. So it really has just kind of a huge impact on the community in general.
Yeah, and it seems to that bicycles may be a more effective solution compared to just handing out money, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the way that we run the program is there is a buy-in from the local community, whether it's the local school or the local individuals, that they do need to kind of take on the responsibility of owning and maintaining the bike. And we find that having that ownership really gives them a much higher vested stake in owning the bike, keeping it running for as long as possible. And then it also gets shared among the community. But we find, you know, if students are using it in the morning, their parents can use it in the afternoon to run errands. Every bike that we distribute tends to impact 3, 4, 5 people as well.
Wow. All right. So tell us a little bit about the bike drive that we've got coming up. When and where is it going to be?
The bike drive is going to be Saturday, May 2nd from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. We're going to be in the Staples / Walmart parking lot in Kimball Junction. This is the 6th year that we've run the Park City Bike Drive, and it has been an essential piece of us sending a shipment from Utah every year. When we send a container of bikes, it's usually 450, 500 bikes, and the Park City Bike Drive typically brings in 20 to 25% of the bikes that we send during the course of the year. We'll be out there for the 4 hours again, Saturday, May 2nd, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. We also ask if people have the means, if they could contribute maybe $20, $25 towards the shipment of the bikes as well. That really helps us get the bikes into the hands of the people that need them.
Yeah. So what bikes do you accept? Anything? I mean, do they need to be in working condition?
I mean, working condition is helpful. If bikes have a flat tire or they need minor repairs, that's not an issue. We will pretty much take anything that still is running and has life to it. We can also take any spare parts, tires, tubes, chains, anything that people have kicking around in their garage or basement that they haven't used in a while. We will take cycling clothing. Pretty much anything we can find a good use for it.
All right. So do you repair the bikes then before they get put into the container? So they're basically ready to go?
We don't repair them here. We have a team of mechanics in both Ghana and Sierra Leone. So when the bikes arrive, they get prepped and repaired, and anything that needs to be fixed gets kind of tuned and updated. So that all gets done in Africa. It also provides employment for our staff there too. So it creates a livelihood for them.
Yeah. Any idea over those 26 years how many bikes you've sent off?
Well, I think we're up over 150,000 right now.
Wow, that's impressive. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe just walk us through, if you could, what happens after somebody here in Park City donates a bike? I mean, how does it get from their garage to a village in West Africa?
Yeah, that's a great question, Leslie. So we store the bikes. We have two storage areas that we keep the bikes here. When the bikes get donated, we kind of break them down. We'll take the pedals off, kind of turn the handlebars, make them as small as possible so we can pack as many as we can in the container. And then once we hit our target number, again, probably 450-ish, we have another 40-foot shipping container that comes in. We load it up, pack it with everything we can, pretty much fill it to the gills. Any open space gets filled with, you know, helmets or whatever we can fit in there. It usually takes about 6 weeks to 2 months for the bikes to arrive in Africa. And then once they're there, our team on the ground unloads the container, sorts the bikes into different sizes and potential regions for where the bikes would be best suited. And then we have pretty much the consistent demand on the ground in both Ghana and Sierra Leone that we could send 10 times as many bikes each year and not keep up with the demand there. So it's a pretty consistent stream. As soon as the bikes are arriving in the country and they're prepped and ready to go, our team is taking them out into the field and then distributing to the local beneficiaries.
Now, are the bikes just coming from Utah, or do you collect from other places?
We have partners all over the country in the UK, so we'll ship about 20 containers a year, but we have other organizations around the US that collect and ship bikes for us. For the container that we send from Utah, we work with the Salt Lake City Bike Collective. They give us some bikes. We work with some of the local Trek dealers and some of the other local bike shops. And then we also go as far away as Boise to pick up bikes from the Boise Bike Project. And it's that cumulative accumulation of bikes that are coming in from all these different partners that allow us to hit that goal every year.
Wow. And then how do you determine who gets a bike once they get to Africa?
That's pretty much left up to most of our teams. We have an application process, so communities or schools that are interested in receiving the bikes send an application to our country directors in Ghana and Sierra Leone, and then they go through a vetting process to kind of determine the needs or the higher need individuals in that community to receive the bikes.
Okay. And I guess just given the infrastructure in Africa, I'm thinking you would prefer bikes that mountain bikes over a road bike?
Yeah, typically the bikes that we send out in programs, like older mountain bikes, are our bread and butter. Ditto with any sort of hybrids or kind of city bikes. They all work well in the terrain that we typically see. We also have a couple of nascent cycling teams in both Ghana and Sierra Leone, so we do take road bikes as well. That's been an interesting offshoot of the program in that we've been able to develop these racing teams that have given some of the local cyclists an opportunity to compete on an international level, which is really just amazing to see.
Yeah, and with the proliferation of e-bikes, are those also accepted?
We do take e-bikes. They are highly prized there. If you are going to send an e-bike, please, you know, bring the charger, bring everything with it. Same as e-bikes here, they really expand the mobility of the people that we're distributing them to. Typically, if we do get e-bikes, they will get into the hands of healthcare workers because we find that that's where they have the biggest impact.
Okay. Joshua, anything else you'd like to tell us?
No, I just want to thank the Park City community for supporting us these last 5 or 6 years. We could not send these shipments without the support that we get, and we hope to see everybody on Saturday, May 2nd.
Okay, and again, that's going to be in the Staples Walmart parking lot there. Between
Correct.
9 and 1, you said?
9 and 1, yes.
Okay, Joshua, thanks for your time this morning.
Great, thanks, Leslie. Always a pleasure.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Utah Housing Coalition will host its annual awards dinner next week, and two Park City-based organizations will be honored. The Coalition is a membership-based organization that provides education, advocacy, and community building around affordable housing. It also hosts Utah's largest housing conference, which brings together housing innovators from across the country. Project manager Zoe Newman says the Coalition sees itself as a connector to help increase the state's affordable housing stock. Newman says they aren't affordable housing developers, but they develop strategic partnerships to get it built. The most challenging affordable housing to build, she says, is for those living at or below the 30% area median income.
We have a 44,000 unit deficit in our state of deeply affordable housing, that 30% AMI or below. That's our workforce. Those are people that support our economy, which is why it's important to celebrate when people are able to make these projects pencil and do innovative stuff, kind of like what they're doing in Park City, and why we're celebrating two different projects in Park City at our awards dinner.
This year, Mountain Mediation Center will receive the Coalition's first ever Housing Stability and Solutions Award. Newman says Mountain Mediation helps people stay in their community, connects them to local resources, and educates them how to be good tenants.
They provide bilingual education on tenant issues. They help mediate with situations and help really underserved populations be able to stay stable in their housing. And they also have provided and created a lot of like housing stability education, and they're really getting out in communities and helping folks get connected to resources right in their community.
Park City Municipal and developer Jay Fisher will be honored with the Green Project of the Year for the public-private partnership development off of Kearns Boulevard Engine House.
This is a very fun project. They built it in a way where not only it is energy efficient, but it is affordable and includes 99 affordable units inside of it. But it's a great affordable housing project that was built with energy efficiency in mind. It has like solar features and other features that not only contribute to energy efficiency, but also to people's cost in their homes. And so it allows utility costs to be reduced for residents.
The sold-out awards dinner will be held April 29th in Salt Lake City. A motorhome caught fire on Interstate 84 in North Summit County Wednesday, sparking a small grass fire and closing the road. The North Summit Fire District responded to the fire near Echo Junction at about 5:30 yesterday morning. The road was closed to all westbound traffic for about 2 hours as crews put out the burn. Utah Fire Info reports the fire spread less than an acre before crews extinguished the flames. North Summit Fire says no one was injured. It is Summit County's 12th wildfire so far this year. Utah Fire Info says all of the county's fires have been human caused, the largest burning 5 acres. Most have sparked along I-80 and I-84. Wasatch County's 2 wildfires since January were kept to an acre or less. Of the state's 106 wildfires so far, 87 were human-caused, including the state's largest, the Goshen Canyon Fire. It's burned about 400 acres on the border of Utah and Juab County since it started on Tuesday. And Heber City will implement a policy guiding its use of artificial intelligence. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the rules are designed to help city staff use the developing technology prudently.
Heber City staff will be able to use artificial intelligence to help them with their work, as long as they disclose how it's used and follow other guidelines. Council members unanimously approved the city's AI policy at a meeting Tuesday. Lainey Myers, who works in the city manager's office, said she refined the policy based on feedback from the council in January.
We added a prohibited uses section and then made sure to establish quarterly training that is mandatory for department heads as well as supervisors.
Staff will be trained on information security, records retention, and more. They'll also learn about the limitations of AI, such as bias and hallucinations, which are responses from the technology that are factually incorrect or fabricated. To keep city data private, employees will not be allowed to use free or public AI tools. Staff will be prohibited from using AI for decisions like hiring or firing. When staff use AI to create materials that are shared with council members or the public, they must note how it was used. Councilmember Aaron Sheetwood, who works in information technology, said he's pleased with how the policy turned out.
I tell clients all the time, your employees are using AI, even if you don't have a policy. They are. The benefit of a policy helps people to realize where risks might be.
City leaders have said they envision using AI to help with meeting minutes, zoning applications, and more. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, despite a lackluster winter, Deer Valley Resort still had a record-breaking season. KPCW's Christine Weller explains.
Ski resorts throughout Utah struggled with the lack of snowfall this winter. Many opened to skiers and riders late in the season and closed early. Deer Valley Resort was no exception, but President Todd Bennett said it was still a record-setting year.
It was definitely a little anticlimactic, but I am so proud of what the team was able to pull off. We made more snow than we've ever made. We were in the neighborhood of, probably 500 million gallons of snowmaking this year.
The man-made snow helped the resort open more terrain than ever before, with 185 of over 200 runs getting tracks. That's 70 more than last year. Bennett said about 100 of those runs opened for the first time, along with 7 new chairlifts. The team got creative to make some openings a reality, especially around Christmas when temperatures weren't dropping.
We had extra snow at the base of the pinion lift, and the grooming and the cat team decided we're going to take one bucket load at a time, literally a front end loader on the cat, and build a run to the top of pinion just to get that open for the holiday guests.
The latest snowmaking technology at Deer Valley's East Village was a big help. Bennett said the Techno Alpine snowmaking systems push out a lot of snow. On the coldest days during the season, Deer Valley's over 300 snow guns were putting out around 19,000 gallons of snow per minute. Still, the resort didn't see an increase in visitors. Previous projections showed a 20% increase year over year thanks to the expansion, but Bennett is hoping for more visitors next season. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.